Welcome to This Week in Private Markets, a podcast by TAP. We give investors, allocators, advisors, and others a weekly digest that keeps you in the know about the news in private markets. Please see the show notes for relevant disclaimers. And this is the week of December 18th, right before Christmas. And this is what we at TAP saw in private markets. We'll start, as always, with the big deals of the week. Alteryx is going private and being acquired by PE firms for $4.4 billion. AP3 and Wafra are introducing a new PE investment platform called Covalent, which will be capitalized with a little over $1 billion and seeks to focus on investments in North America and Europe. With that, let's jump into the main stories of the week. The main thing on everyone's mind, of course, is the prospect of rate cuts in 2024 and the impact that will have on the private equity industry, right? Will it break the current logjam with transactions? Will it kick activity back into higher gear? There's a lot of different sort of approaches to take to this, right? Some people say the rates will only be cut if there's a major economic event that will, of course, have a negative impact on everything. The other camp, which seems to be sort of the consensus view right now, is that it's going to be a smooth landing. Rates will come down. It will all be managed well, and bid-ask spreads will come down, interest rate drag on deals will come down, financing will be cheaper. Adam, Jeff, where do you guys land on this? Pun unintended.
Yeah, I mean, look, we don't know. I think, you know, what happens next year with respect to the economy is obviously a different question. So I don't know. If there's a soft landing, great. You know, I obviously hope for that, and that'd be great for everyone.
There's definitely the pricing of a soft landing. If you look at the public equity markets, for instance, you know, the rates have gone down recently, like the longer term rates have gone down. And sometimes that, you know, the yield curve being inverted in that way, where the longer term rates are lower than the short term rates, you know, is a predictor that the Fed will lower interest rates because there's a recession. Like that's what's being predicted that's going to happen with interest rates. In this case, it's not the case. They're saying they're going to lower interest rates because inflation comes down. And the way you can see that is because the equity markets are so high. Right. So I think, Thomas, you're right that the consensus is that the rates coming down as a result of a soft landing rather than a hard landing, both of which would cause rates to come down from here, to be clear. And right. The impact of that on private markets, obviously, of a soft landing is great. A hard landing would be very bad. Obviously, you'd get lower rates, but you'd have other impacts on the businesses that private equity firms own. And generally, all the assets that are owned in private markets would be impacted negatively by a bad economic environment. Soft landing would be quite good. Having the rates come down would kind of clear up this logjam you're talking about. So obviously, if the markets are correct, which they're more correct more often than not, then this would be good for it. Now, obviously, it's a prediction of the markets, and they've been wrong often too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to take a position on it. I mean, who knows, right? There's also the potential for sort of massive, you know, geopolitical shocks to also really change the prognosis for next year. I think if the question is, will falling rates or more stabilized rates improve deal making in 2024? I mean, I think the answer is probably yes. You know, there might be some air of people might err on the side of caution potentially, but you know, in 2022 and 2023, you obviously saw a lot of, you know, self-reinforcing, you know, phenomena occurring in the market. Higher rates, obviously, you know, causes, you know, debt to be more expensive, causes less deal making, also makes exits more difficult. And all that obviously causes LPs, you know, to deploy or to commit less capital to all of these private funds, right? Which in turn hurts GPs as well. And it's a bit of a vicious cycle. So again, if you do relax the pressure on rates and you do see those coming down, then with some caution, I mean, surely that'll improve, you know, private equity exits and fundraising and overall.
The issue in which it potentially doesn't, I mean, if you look at what the logjam is that causes there to be basically low volume, right, of all sorts of transactions in private markets, it's the fact that there's a bid-ask spread. There is a difference in expectations between the buyers and sellers of assets. So private equity firms actually have more dry powder than they've ever had before, right? I think it was was it 3 or 4 trillion? I mean, who, you know, give or take a trillion here or there.
Yeah, what is a trillion among friends?
they have, you know, trillions of dollars of dry powder, and there's pretty much still capital burning a hole in people's pockets to want to invest it. The problem is that a lot of businesses, the markets look, their actual businesses are doing pretty well. They have plenty of cash. They don't need to raise money, and they don't need to sell their business potentially at a time where they think the valuation is off. And so there's this difference in expectations that comes out. And, you know, I think the worrisome part of a soft landing, and this is the part that hasn't helped, is just that it keeps the expectations of the sellers, in this case, the business owners, who are thinking about selling those assets, high, while in reality here, we still have increased rates compared to what the prior valuations were at, where the Fed funds rate was at zero, you know, because no one's talking, you know, I think the predictions are something more like, you know, like no one's talking that it's going to be going to zero anytime soon, right? And that would probably indicate that something bad had happened. So, yeah, I don't know. It doesn't necessarily mean just because there's a soft landing does not mean that we'd break this sort of logjam, as they call it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't think you're going to see deal making reverse back to the levels it was at, right? Not at all. But at the end of the day, this is just LBO math, right? I mean, assume the same prices, assume high prices, you know, cheaper debt, less cash going to pay your interest expense does make your LBO math easier. So, I mean, even, you know, on balance incrementally, this should lead to some more activity, though I totally agree it's not going to get back to those levels.
You can go one layer further back too and say, okay, so we're talking now about, like, you know, PE firms or venture firms or whatever firms trying to acquire assets. But you go one layer back and you say, well, then what about, you know, LPs who might want to invest in here? And obviously there's liquidity issues where they're getting more, they're getting fewer distributions. I think I was seeing in this Cambridge data that this is the lowest proportional amount of distributions in the last 25 years that they've gotten out.
Yeah.
And obviously, they're still having contributions, but you can see from the dry powder, like, it's not really like there's not an appetite to invest, right? This denominator effect that LPs were seeing potentially last year, mid-year, it went away this year, and it's the reverse. You know, public markets have been ripping so hard that, you know, to catch up with your allocation, you should actually be investing more into private markets this year. But, you know, they still wanted to invest. There's all this dry powder on the sidelines, but the key is that the market's kind of frozen up. The prices that private equity is willing to pay, the current holders of those assets are not willing to sell at those prices. And that's where the logjam is. And, you know, unless rates come down a lot, it's not going to break that up. But probably a combination of rates coming down somewhat, and then the business is kind of growing into valuations that make more sense for the current holders of them to sell it at a decent price, is probably how this eventually gets solved. But I wouldn't think of this as getting solved in like an instant. You know, it's not like, oh, hey, we fixed the issue. This is going to flow really quickly again. It's going to more be like, wait, we just don't see this issue anymore. We haven't seen it for a year. And we'll realize that suddenly after a year of having it not really be an issue anymore.
That seems like a good note to conclude this topic on. Good stuff. Let's move on to the topic of water. We've probably all heard this a little bit on the news, but basically there's one private equity firm that owns the majority of the bottled water brands that we know in the US, like Poland Springs, Arrowhead, and a ton of other brands. This PE firm is called Blue Triton, and they are, of course, trying to grow all their brands, and they're growing pretty nicely. And in line with that growth, as one might expect, is growth in the amount of water that they're pumping from, you know, springs, creeks, groundwater supplies. And they're doing this basically all across the US, from Florida to Maine to Colorado, Texas, California, pretty much all over the place, wherever there's good water, I guess. And there's a concern that this growth rate, which is about, it's up about 35% since 2020, so pretty rapid growth, that is having a real negative effect on the ecosystems, the groundwater supplies in those areas.
Yeah, well, this is obviously very lucrative for these, you know, bottled water brands and their owners. You know, the way a lot of these other companies like Coca-Cola or Pepsi, for example, procure their water is they actually take tap water from municipalities, right? And they pay for that tap water from those municipalities. These guys obviously go straight to the source. you know, straight to the springs where, you know, water is much, much cheaper, if not free. So, I mean, yeah, you can imagine, you know, with that kind of sort of cost basis that it would lead to some pressure on the spring, right? I mean, I've expressed this view before on this podcast. I'm generally not a fan of, you know, this kind of private ownership over, you know, perhaps resources that face collective action problems, or, you know, resources that are, you know, very important to sort of, you know, human survival and human wellness. But, you know, that clearly what's happening here is, you know, they're taking advantage of, you know, a really cheap source of water. And it makes complete sense why they would do that versus going, you know, to the towns and paying for that, like Coca-Cola would.
I'm curious, do you guys know anything about the cost structure that they have with these springs? Because, you know, usually when you talk about sort of environmental things, whether it's pollution or, you know, water like this, there's always this concept of unpriced externalities, right, in sort of traditional economics. And then
I think they own, in most cases here, they own rights to take a certain amount of the water from that location. So I don't think it's like they pay a certain amount per, you know, million gallons or whatever
they basically have a limit.
They own a right. They own the rights. They have a limit. You know, generally those rights can be bought and sold, and they bought them at some point for some price that was fair at the time. Then the actual, like, you know, economics of the underlying business are just like very low margin. As you can imagine, this is a pretty commoditized thing. You know, buying water, bottled water is pretty much a commodity. And so they're not, you know, making huge margins on these, this bottled water business. And so the incentive to sort of decrease their costs internally is pretty high to try and, you know, eke out a little bit more margin.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think this path obviously makes sense, and you could also credibly claim it is spring water and not, you know, purified tap water, which I'm sure many, many bottled water brands do.
I think you'd want that would be in a consideration, right? Like, if everyone hears that it's tap water, that's not a great thing, right? But my understanding is it pretty much is, in terms of like the way they treat it and what they do to it. I mean, it pretty much comes out to be the same thing. I think the interesting thing here about, you know, this sort of idea of these negative externalities is, like, I mean, while I do think there's something to focus on here, and I don't know much about this subject, I just know, and the article did mention this, that we had that we're reciting here, was talking about how, you know, agriculture is a way, way bigger user of water than this. This is like a drop in the bucket, no pun intended, in the overall scheme of things of how much water is being used here. Like, yeah, there's a lot of bottled water in the world, but it is nothing compared to the water that we spray all over the crops used for industrial and agricultural purposes. So I would be more concerned about all the plastic being generated by all this stuff than I would that we're going to somehow run out of water from literally drinking it in bottles from the store. Like, I think there's a lot of negative externalities from bottled water, and probably not the one that's going to break the camel's back would not be actually running out of groundwater to take.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably right. I think the only distinction here is that, you know, because you're extracting water so close to its source, you know, you're sort of disproportionately damaging those spring area. Flows.
Yeah, specific area.
You know, I'm not an environmentalist or, you know, a geologist, or I don't even know what the right you know, specialty here is to opine on this. But I think that's the argument. Obviously there are, you know, a ton of other negative externalities, as you mentioned, you know, microplastics or whatever, you know, associated with bottled water.
And I mean, the difficult part about it, you know, is that these firms, they take on leverage, and leverage makes people do crazy things, right? And it makes you potentially use a resource in a way that you wouldn't use it if you were a long-term holder with long-term aspirations, right? If potentially something goes wrong, or you have the idea that you're going to buy an asset and flip it, you might have a different incentive structure than if you were the long-term holder of an asset and really wanted to use it. And that's where you can kind of get into this thing where you're kind of exploiting an asset and turning it around. So I think it is, you know, obviously important to be wary of this stuff. And I think most likely, you know, this is the job of the regulator to make sure the amounts of water that you're allowed to take out don't exceed the amount that can healthily be pulled out. I mean, I don't know what else to say. If these guys are pulling water out in a way that is compliant with the rules, like that's how the rules are set up, is to protect, is to help with these negative externalities. Now, they did talk about how you know, that there's a groundwater aspect of, like, there's a gray area in terms of groundwater, you know, who regulates that and how you own it. It's largely more unregulated. So it can get complicated, but more likely the best way to deal with this kind of thing is to have, you know, clear regulations that are meant to prevent the externalities that we're talking about and prevent tragedy of the commons when you don't have clear ownership rights.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. What these guys are really doing is they're socializing these negative externalities that are really being created because of, you know, some consumer demand, right? Far, far away from the communities around these springs, right? So you're socializing those negative externalities on a community that's, you know, completely out of sight, out of mind, for those really benefiting from, you know, whatever the spring water is. If there is a benefit to spring water versus, Dasani, which I think is Coca-Cola or Pepsi and clearly tap water.
Right. But my gut feel is that this pales in comparison to other issues that are out there. That's just my gut. I mean, I, like I said, I'm not an expert on this, but my gut feel is that, like, it's not actually at those limits, and this is not really an actual major issue.
Very good. Let's move on to the next topic, which is the age-old question of whether to invest in private or public markets and where you can get the better returns. So investors are constantly kind of trying to figure out different metrics, different ways of evaluating, you know, the performance of both sides of the market, right? Private and public. And Japan's government pension fund recently came up with a new refinement to the PME method. And
Is it enough?
That's right. Of course, it compares with the direct alpha and the Kaplan-Shore methods. I'm sure there are different loyalists. Where do you guys fall?
So PME has been around for a long while as a way to measure public versus private markets. And, you know, I'd love to talk a little bit about what it is, but I'll say first off that it really hasn't gotten very much adoption. I mean, you know, I think a lot of tech platforms and folks in Excel have calculated this in the past, but people are not really evaluating their private programs based off of PME, despite the fact that, if you were an academic, you'd look at it and say, well, this is kind of the only way of making this assessment. This is really how you should look at private markets is on a comparable basis to public markets. And, some of the ways these things are calculated and is what you really look at is, if I had invested the same funds that I, like when the contributions went into a fund, if I invested that into the S&P 500 or Russell 3000 or whatever you want to use as your benchmark, what would my return be off of that public market stock index be? And what was the return, the IRR I had based off of the cash flows that I actually had in the private markets? And then you kind of just take a ratio of those. So for instance, you might have a PME. If you had a 20% IRR in your fund and you looked at what the equivalent cash flows would have been if you had invested that money instead at the same times into the Russell 3000 and that was 10%, then you'd have a 2 PME. You'd have private markets double the performance of the public markets. And there's kind of different ways to phrase it. You can look at it as a percentage spread. You can look at it as a ratio. But this is a little bit more complicated to calculate, but not really, to be honest with you. It's approximately the same. But folks have not used it in the past as a way to evaluate their investments. It just has not caught on. And my opinion about why it hasn't caught on is that it's not really a percentage type of thing. It's a multiple of a public index, which it's just hard to say, hey, our returns, what were our returns this year? They were 1.5, the public market returns. It's just hard to hold on to that. If I say, look, our returns were, have been 3X on this fund, right? We have a 3X MOIC on this fund, or we have a 15% annualized return in IRR. Those are like very easy things to sort of like say in an absolute sense. PME is very much more like a benchmarking thing. It's always in relation to the public markets. And so I think it's harder to say that's sort of like the benchmark return. But yeah, I don't know what your thoughts are on this, Adam, but this is kind of like my take on this particular subject.
Yeah, I mean, to answer Thomas's initial question, I'm not a loyalist in either methodology or in the Japan government pensions refinement, whatever the refinement is. I think a couple of things. I agree with you, Jeff. I mean, it's one thing to say, look, my return is you know, my private equity fund's return is 1.5 times, right, whatever public benchmark I decide to use. That's clear. I mean, that's just math. But there's a second order level question that's more important, and that is, well, is that incremental return, I mean, does that make up for the illiquidity, for the risk, for, you know, whatever other increased embedded risks there are in private markets, you know, vis-a-vis public markets, right? Notably, not being able to exit those at will, more opaque reporting. I mean, you can list several, right? So I think that's a bit harder to conceptualize. And then it's a bit harder to sort of make that really specific, right? And put that into quantitative terms, into real numbers, and then to actually apply that, right, to your portfolio management. So, you know, I think that is a challenging bit. I'd be interested to see how, you know, pension funds or, you know, Japan's government pension thinks about it that way vis-a-vis those risks in private markets. I think the other point, though, is, you know, look, for the better part of the last decade, you didn't really have to think about it too much. You know, I think now in the last year, you know, in particularly in our business at TAP, when, you know, we've got perhaps, you know, venture or growth equity funds, right, being transacted through our platform, you know, buyers for the first time in a long time are saying, well, look, on a relative multiples basis, why wouldn't I just go buy a bunch of public SaaS companies, you know, for right, 6-7 times revenue? I'm not going to go buy something equally expensive or even more expensive in the private market on a multiples basis, when, you know, I'm not necessarily going to get the same kind of value appreciation to justify that multiple differential, right? So, you know, we haven't really had to ask these questions in a very long time. In addition to the fact that I think it is a bit hard to really quantify the kind of private market risks as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that it is a question that should be being asked right now, especially, I mean, when you're more fully allocated, when you do have the choice between the two, there are more programs than ever that have capabilities, you know, of investing in either market, private or public, and they should really be asking themselves this question. And it's kind of a hard thing to answer without looking at something like this. This, the PME, I am kind of a loyalist. I do like the PME. No one ever uses it. I think it's like one of these academically obvious things when you look at it. It's not difficult to calculate, not difficult to understand the output or the inputs into it. Like, I could show you an Excel spreadsheet exactly where everything comes from and how it works. So, like, I think it's a very good measure. And maybe it does come down to what you're talking about, that people really haven't had to make this choice in a long while. It was just sort of, we're underallocated in private markets. It keep going upwards. Let's get more into them. Now they're more fully allocated. The valuation, you know, is looking different between the two, and maybe it makes more sense, you know, to have that conversation now and use the metric now than it did before.
All right, let's move on to some deal news. The media mogul Shari Redstone is in talks to sell a controlling stake in National Amusements. While you might not have heard of National Amusements, it is the parent company of tons of entertainment companies, notably Paramount Movie Studios, also CBS, also Nickelodeon, and even MTV. And we've seen quite a lot of PE activity in entertainment recently, and this could be a great strategic acquisition. It could be a great standalone acquisition. There's obviously a lot of brand power here. Let's throw it over to our media correspondent, Jeff. What do you make of this?
I think there was a very big saga that I didn't fully follow around, you know, Shari Redstone getting control of this in the first place. It was like a big piece of drama, you know, with their father who was quite old and all this. And now they wanted to sell this, it seems. I mean, media can go up and down and sideways, and I'm sure that they will find a good home for these assets and continue to consolidate the assets. I don't think that Paramount, you know, they have Paramount Plus stuff, but they never rose to the level. They didn't have the Disney brand clout to sort of launch their own streaming service that could compete. And if you can't compete as being one of the apps that people are going to go to, if you don't have, you know, live sports, if you don't have that like direct consumer brand ID and relationship, then you're not going to fare very well in this market. And so you're going to get snapped up by someone else who can. So I think there's a bunch of people who are circling as potential buyers, because I think, I'm sure all the assets are very strong, but just like as a standalone business, hard to make it work. So like, I would expect this to go more strategic acquire than to go in the hands of someone who's looking to cash flow the assets.
Yeah, I mean, if I were, I think the banker's name was Byron Trott, who I guess merged his own firm with Michael Dell's family office earlier this year. I didn't realize this guy was so rich. He's apparently worth like $3 billion from his media banking days, but probably more so from this merger more recently. If I had my banker hat on, I'd probably say there's a room for both strategic and private equity acquirers here. I'd probably divide up the business that way. You know, Disney's not going to buy a linear television business. You know, that's in secular decline. That's not really what Disney's there for, right? They sort of want IP. They want growth assets. But, you know, linear TV, while it's declining every single year, is still a great cash flow positive flowing business, right? So I could be Apollo, I could be KKR, I could be one of these big buyout firms. And look, I could have a 3 to 5 year horizon on my linear television business, and that probably could still produce a pretty strong, you know, 30 to 40% IRR, for example. So, you know, I'd probably divide that up, sell off the growthier assets or really the valuable IP to a strategic partner. But then, you know, there's some good, real traditional private equity businesses in here that don't require growth, that frankly just need to produce cash flow, even if that cash flow declines, you know, 3 or 4% every year. And that'll probably still clear your IRR hurdles at a lot of these PE funds. Obviously pending, you know, rate decreases next year. So we'll see how that all plays out.
Good stuff. Well, we're running short on time here, so we're going to have to do TAP's first lightning round. Basically, the chair of the Financial Stability Board has warned about the danger of private markets in 2024. Particularly, he points out high levels of leverage and liquidity mismatches, with sort of an emphasis on credit and leverage amount, you know, floating around all these non-bank institutions, right? What happens there in the event of a shock? Is there a systemic disruption? So in 30 seconds or less, Adam, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, of course, right? And we'll cover this next week on kind of our you know, wrap up of the whole year. But this year has seen large alternative asset managers, you know, or private markets actors, you know, increase in strength in a number of ways. I know it's, you know, fundraising's been challenging, exits have been challenging, all that notwithstanding, you know, the titans of this area, whether it's Apollo or KKR or CBC. You know, they've all, you know, many have gone public newly, many have acquired insurance units and wealth management units, right? So obviously they've all grown to a considerable degree. They are commingling various types of businesses. They are providing billions of dollars of non-bank, you know, finance to various industries and sectors around the economy. So, of course, I mean, this is the right thing to call out. And, you know, I think it'll continue to be a theme into 2024 without a doubt.
And okay, I'll go even briefer on my lightning round, which is just a few words: leverage, opacity, non-mark to market. And these are all the things that this, you know, banking sector that we're talking about here, where they're lending, has. I think it's very important that they do what they're doing at the FCA and get more data. They still haven't shown us a smoking gun of where does this actually go wrong? Where are the assets mingled together? Where's the systemic risk? But you know, when there's opacity, leverage, when people aren't marking to market, you know that somewhere in that whole thing is probably some sort of risk. I want them to point out what it is before they go crazy on it, but I want them to figure out what it is and then surgically deal with it.
Yeah, you got to throw in the word contagion in there too, right? Like, I want to know if Apollo fails, when does my, you know, RIA...
That's what I want them to figure out.
I lose my insurance at the same time.
That's what I'm saying is they haven't shown the contagion part yet. They haven't shown that. We know there's opacity, we know there's leverage, we know there's all this stuff, but I want them to go and find where can the contagion be? Where can be the systemic risk where assets can fail and it causes the whole system to fail?
Excellent. Well,
it's too late.
We wish all our listeners a happy Christmas, happy holidays, or just a great week if you're not celebrating anything. We'll be back with our wrap-up episode next week. Until then,